promised it for so long that I found I couldn't get out of it. So I'm going to preach on Job today, mostly. It's not that bad, actually. But before I say anything about Job in particular, I wanted to say something about Alfred Hitchcock. There's a famous interview, some of you may have seen it, where someone asked Alfred Hitchcock about his movies, about how they were structured, and because they're all kind of the same in a certain way. You know, there's all these crime or this conspiracy, and you know, a lot of action around that. And they asked him about how he'd set up his films, and he says, "What really is important in my films," he said, "was what happens to the characters and the action that takes place in the middle, and that's where the point of the movie really lies." Now, there's something in every movie that he does, he says, some item, something which everyone is pursuing, something very important to the plot which drives all the action. And everybody thinks that this is the important thing, but actually, it's not at all. It's kind of interchangeable. He even had a word for it. He called it a MacGuffin. And a MacGuffin is something that doesn't really matter to the plot at all, but everybody in the movie is chasing after it, and it gives the structure and drives the plot so that there is all this action and all this dialogue can take place, which is really what the point of the movie is. The Book of Job is sort of like that, especially the way it's been read in the lectionary the last 4 weeks. There's this kind of plot device, kind of a MacGuffin, which drives the whole story. And that is, in this case, the fact that at the beginning, Job, who is very well-to-do and has everything he wants, has these terrible things happen to him. And all these disasters happen at the beginning of the story become for us kind of the point of the story if we're focused on the plot. But it's really not what the story is about at all. What's happened in the last few weeks, while Job, parts of Job have been covered in the lectionary, is that there's this conversation in the middle, which is, probably constitutes 95% of the entire book, which has been almost entirely left out. And that conversation is actually the point of the story. All the other things that happened on to Job at the beginning happen so that you can have Job having this conversation that covers most of the book. Anyway, I'll give you a short synopsis of that, because you didn't get it in the movie. Job starts out, as I said, as a man who has everything. He has wealth. He has family. He has respect. He even has a good relationship with God. He's a person that people come to when they have problems. They want to discuss things with him because he's wise and respected. And he just has everything that a man could want, in this society particularly. And what we're told of then, after that setup, is that there's a scene in heaven. And this kind of court that God holds in his heavenly palace, so to speak. And Satan comes up to him. Now, Satan in this story, I don't really think is supposed to be what we think of as Satan, as the devil, and on all of it, what that means. Satan in Hebrew comes from a word that kind of means something like prosecuting attorney, you know? And the way this works is, you know, Satan has been kind of walks around on the earth and says, he's guilty. Guilty. I'm going to tell God about that. I'm going to figure you out what you're doing, and you're going to get yours. And so he's up, you know, talking to God one day, and God's talking presumably about all the people that, you know, Satan, you know, he says, where have you been, Satan? Satan says, well, I've been walking around, you know, accusing people. And he says, yeah, but you haven't said anything about my friend Job. I mean, Job is this great guy, and you just look at him. Look at how he's got everything, and he's faithful, and he's never sinning, and he brings other people to me, and Satan says, yeah, uh-huh, and he's really prosperous, too. You take all that away from him and see what happens. And God says, all right, take everything he has, but don't touch him. So the next thing that happens is that the house that Job's family is in blows over, and all his children are crushed, and all of his wealth is taken away, and there's this almost humorous scene where these people keep coming up to Job saying, this terrible thing happened, and the house fell in, and I only survived to tell you. And then we sing, really? And then someone goes, well, all your goats and cattle were taken up in a whirlwind and everything was destroyed, and I alone survived to tell you. And this happens like about four times. And Job says, oh, but he doesn't turn away from God. So then he goes back to the other scene, and God says, see, what did I tell you? And Satan says, well, that's true, but you didn't do anything to him now, did you? So he says, all right, you do nasty things to Job's body. Don't kill him, but do anything you want to him, and then we'll talk. So the next thing that happens is that Job gets boils, and all these terrible things happen to him. And he ends up sitting on this heap of dirt, and then his wife comes by and says, why don't you just curse God and die? And then she walks off. So, you know, he tears his clothes, shaves his beard, and sits in the dust. That's the MacGuffin part. The main part of the book, which, like I say, we didn't read these last weeks, begins right here. Three friends of Job arrive, and they come and they sit with him. And they just sit with him silently for 7 days because, I mean, who can say anything to Job at this point? And then at the end of 7 days, they start to talk about what happened and why this is going on. Of course, none of them really knows, but the friends kind of think that they know. And essentially what comes out of this conversation is that the friends assume that Job has done something really, really wrong to deserve this kind of treatment. Job then denies that he's guilty of anything serious enough to warrant this fate, and he starts to talk about how distant and absent God is. He has no way to find God and appeal his case to him. He suddenly is frightened that God isn't there, and he says things like, wherever he is, God is so far away that I have no way, I don't know if my words are reaching, I don't know how to say anything to him. And then the friends then turn around, and they start to become increasingly annoyed with Job because they keep saying, yes, but you see, God is always punishing the wicked and rewarding the good, so you must be wicked because a lot of really bad things have been happening to you. And then Job, in his turn, gets annoyed with them because they're not showing him any sympathy, and it kind of goes on and on like that for pages and pages. What this is really all about, of course, is what theologians call theodicy. And theodicy is basically the question, why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? Or why does God allow bad things to happen if he is both good and powerful? It's one of those big theological questions which no one ever really answers. Job's friends, though, give a very conventional answer. And it's, in fact, an answer that you find kind of frequently in parts of the Old Testament, earlier parts of the Bible. Part of it was even in the Psalm today. And that answer, of course, is that God punishes the wicked and rewards the virtuous. Now, the problem, of course, for any of us that have been alive on this planet for more than about, 18 minutes, is that that's just not the way the world really works. At least not in the short run. Good people often suffer, while good people often seem to get away with things. How do we explain this? Can we explain this? And this is the problem that keeps going back around and around between Job and his friends. And they keep saying, well, it's like this. And Job says, you're not telling the truth. You're not saying what you really see. In fact, he says to them at some point, God is not served by falsehoods. And their reply is, what you're saying is not as flattering to God as what we're saying. Keep that in mind for a moment. At the end, after Job and his friends have finished talking, kind of past each other, they fall silent, as if there's nothing more to say. And then suddenly the Lord himself appears out of a whirlwind. And there's this long speech by God where he starts saying, mostly to Job, where were you when I created the earth? Where were you when I created the mountains? Do you know how I made the trees? Do you know how all this stuff goes together? And at some point he says, so can you tell me? And Job says, I don't have anything to say. I'm really small. And then God says, okay, well then tell me how I created the whales. And then it goes on like that. Basically he's saying, who are you and what do you know? How can you, who know so little, really assume that you know anything? And then Job gives his famous answer, which was in the reading today. I heard you by the hearing of my ear, but now I see you with my eyes. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. After this, then God says, Job was right. And then he says to the friends, you have spoken falsely, and I'm not going to forgive you unless Job prays for you, which he does, and everybody's friends again. In the end, Job's extended family then kind of comes back, and they comfort him. And the Lord blesses him and makes him wealthier than before, and he gets a new family, and he lives for a very, very long time. So there you go, Job. I don't have to explain that Job is notoriously difficult. And there's a lot of ideas about what it means. And I do have to say that editing of this lectionary doesn't help. But the story is a problem itself. It's difficult to understand at the end what exactly has happened or why it happened in the first place. And none of it is helped by the fact that no one is absolutely sure how to even translate the thing. Even the original Hebrew has words. There's actually a technical word for it that means a word alone. There are words in Job that appear nowhere else in the Bible and nowhere else in any inscription or any other source we have in Hebrew. So we actually don't even know necessarily what the word means. We're only guessing at what some of the passages are actually saying. So the whole meaning of the text itself is unclear. Despite all of that, there's a kind of standard surface interpretation. Basically, that Job is about faithfulness. It's about obedience, patience. Job suffers, but he remains faithful, and in the end, God rewards him. End of story, a nice, neat version. Except that if you actually read the book, it doesn't say that. I will venture to say this. If there's anything about the book that we can say that it's about there are no easy answers. In fact, one of the things that you can say that the book is in fact saying is you must reject the easy answers. Like I say, most of the book is about Job's friends telling him that he must have done something terribly sinful. Job says, no, I didn't. I'm just suffering. But in the end, God agrees with Job, who had said, God is not served by falsehoods. Not even falsehoods that seem to flatter God. And God says to Job, you have spoken rightly, and the friends are the ones who must ask forgiveness, both of Job and of God. So what does that leave us about suffering? Job never gets an answer. No answer that says, this is why there is suffering. He gets this long speech, which simply reinforces the fact that he doesn't know anything. The only answer about suffering itself that Job seems to get is, well, it's kind of a mystery. It's worked into the way the world works. Don't worry about it. But there's more to it than that. What Job is saying all through the time that he's lamenting and mourning and sitting on that pile of dirt, again and again, is he says, I cannot understand why I've been abandoned. I thought God was my friend, and now I can't even feel God's presence. I can't understand why these friends have traveled so far, and they come here, and they just tell me that I'm a bad person. I can't understand why I'm suddenly alone. Why has everyone turned against me? He doesn't break the relationships, but he doesn't understand why they're not working. And what that speech that God makes to him in the end says this one thing. God reaffirms that, yes, Job, I am your friend. He answers Job. He meets him, and he touches him again. And Job says, before this, I heard with my ears, but now I see with my eyes. Job has learned something deeper and more meaningful about what it is to be human, even in the midst of suffering. Suddenly, he can say, ah, I do feel that presence again. I do know that God is with me. And then he's reconciled with his friends. And then after that, his brothers and sisters arrive, and everyone is there to comfort him. The beginning of Job's restoration isn't the restoration of his wealth, but it's the restoration of his relationships, first and foremost of his relationship with God. And though all of this doesn't really answer that kind of philosophical theodicy question, there's something about it, I think, that deeply, deeply strikes me as true. We may suffer, and we may ask, why? Why is there suffering? But I don't think that most of us in the midst of suffering reduce it to some kind of philosophical puzzle. What really concerns us is that loss of relationship. What really concerns us is that fear or sense of emptiness. Is God really there? Is someone caring? Is there any meaning at all to anything? It's the feeling of worry that God is no longer with us. And by extension, the feeling of worry that we're losing our human relationships, our relationships with our friends, our family. What we need, what we really need in order to restore us, is not a logical answer. What we really need is the sense that we're not alone. We need the confidence that God knows us and cares for us. We want to know that we are not alone. Because true suffering lies in isolation and alienation. And that is what Job has overcome by the end of the book. Suddenly he's surrounded by family again. He's connected to God again. When he says, I repent in dust and ashes, he's saying the word repent there isn't repent as in I'm sorry. It's the same word that God uses when he says, I repent that I gave Israel this, or I've changed my mind about this. Job is saying, I was thinking I was seeing it this way, but now I realize it's like this. I'm not alone. Faith based on falsehood is not a faith worth having. Job isn't about easy answers. We must always struggle and wrestle with our doubts and our assumptions. And that's a struggle that we really don't have, in the long run, anything to fear about. What we need to fear is complacency. We must never assume that we have all the answers, like Job's friends did. We must always be engaged with our faith, connected to it, wrestling with it, renewing it. That's an engagement of relationship, of our relationship with God. And that is the key to a sense that we are not alone, to arriving at a place and an understanding that we are not in isolation. We are not suffering by ourselves. We may not have all of the answers. We perhaps cannot possibly understand everything about the way the world works or why. But we can know that we have a relationship and that we are